The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
So the theory of the case must be that Canadians feared the fact that a so-called cold-blooded killer for ISIS was walking around in Canada, and that must generate fear in Canadians that they could be harmed from a terrorist activity, which I think is going to be very challenging to prove. They also need to prove that what he said was false. So in this case, they're going to need to prove the negative, that he did not commit the crimes that he said that he did, to the Caliphate podcast or to CBC.
I'm Jacob Schultz, and this is the Lawfare podcast, October 2nd, 2020. On September 25th, the Royal Canadian Mounted Police arrested a Canadian man for faking his involvement with the Islamic State. It's a strange charge, but the situation is made more complicated by the fact that the man, who goes by the nom de guerre Abu Huzaifa, was the primary subject of the Caliphate, a popular New York Times podcast series about the Islamic State. In that series, Abu Huzaifa talked at length about spending time with the Islamic State and rehashed in great detail his involvement in the executions of prisoners detained by the group. It's a complicated set of facts with a lot to unpack. Do we have any real sense of what happened? What features of the Canadian national security apparatus might have contributed to the bizarre situation? And what does the whole ordeal reveal about the challenges and pitfalls of telling stories about the war on terror? To talk through everything, I talked with Leah West, a lecturer at the Norman Patterson School of International Affairs at Carleton University and a fellow at the McCain Institute, and Amarnath Amarasingham, an assistant professor in the School of Religion at Queen's University. It's the Lawfare Podcast, October 2nd, an Islamic State hoax. So there's a lot going on here, but I think the place to start might just be based on the largely set of agreed upon facts. Amar, could you just describe who this guy is?
Sure. So Abu Huzaifa is a young Pakistani Canadian man. He's currently in university. He's working just outside of Toronto, and he claims to have joined the Islamic State for around 4 to 5 months, I would say, sometime between late 2014 and early 2015, and then returned to Canada. And the way I think he came into public view anyway was Memory, the Middle East Media Research Institute, published a report mostly to its subscribers on November 3rd, 2016, basically saying that there was a person who was posting content on Facebook and Instagram claiming to have fought in Syria and claiming to have now returned to Canada and basically not been charged. And I may be wrong on this, but I think this is probably around the time that the Canadian law enforcement also learned of Huzaifa. From here, Rukmini got a hold of the report. Rukmini Kalamaki from the New York Times got a hold of the report, started digging around, found an email address, and started communicating with him, and eventually interviewed him in Canada on November 15th, I think it was. After a few of those interviews, I think she felt a little uneasy leaving this guy by himself and leaving this guy kind of with no one else to talk to. And so she introduced him to Mubin Sheikh, who's a fairly well-known undercover operative from the Toronto 18 case in 2006, but is now working in the countering violent extremism space. And then Mubin introduced him to me in early December as well. And so that's kind of how, this was 2016, that's kind of how he came on a bunch of people's radar around this time.
So you'd mentioned that he was sort of the subject of this podcast series with the New York Times. So if my only interaction with him and with this case was through listening to the Caliphate podcast, what does, in your view, like, what does this series present him as being?
He's described as someone who traveled to Syria, joined ISIS, served as a member of their police force, eventually started to feel that ISIS wasn't truly representative of the kind of kingdom of God on earth that they presented themselves to be. And he eventually tells of a kind of escape story, steals a motorcycle and heads to the Turkish border, flies back to Pakistan, stays there for a while, and then eventually returns to Canada. In terms of his tone, he comes off, I would say, kind of part remorseful, boastful, and reflective at times throughout. And what I think the podcast makes clear, at least in chapter 5 and 6, is that the New York Times spent an enormous amount of resources and time hunting down the discrepancies in his story, right? So all 40 minutes of chapter 6 of the podcast is basically them trying to figure out what he's lying about and how which parts of his story are true, because I think they eventually conclude that you know, he wasn't there when he said he was. He initially told the podcast that he was there in June of 2014, right when the caliphate was declared, but according to, you know, stamps on his passport and his where he was at in school and things like that at the time, it became clear that he definitely wasn't there when he said he was. And so that opened up a whole other set of questions of what else is he lying about. And so I think eventually the New York Times comes to conclude that certain specific details of a story are probably off, but on the whole of around the question of did he actually go to Syria and fight with the Islamic State, they think he probably did, just not when he said he did.
Right. So there's lots of different ways that the Caliphate sort of tries to place him in Syria when he was there, or sort of tries to get an idea of what he did. And one of those is by sort of using other New York Times reporters to sort of check what U.S. intelligence sources thought of him. So can you just sort of describe to us how at least Caliphate presents the U.S. intelligence community's view of this guy at the time?
Yeah, so I think in that same chapter, in chapter 6, when some of his initial lies become known, of course, the podcast team gets a little worried that he might be lying about the whole thing. And so they undertake kind of three different methods by which to verify parts of his story. One of them is to call on Adam Goldman and Eric Schmidt, these kind of well-known national security reporters at the New York Times, who then make a few phone calls and come back and say that that American law enforcement is aware of someone by this name, that he is on the no-fly list, and that he is suspected of having joined and fought with the Islamic State. And so I think those sources feed into kind of chapter 6 of the podcast and provide some confidence to the podcast team that at the very least, the scaffolding, as they eventually call it, of the story must be true, that at least we can maybe deduce that he did go there and did join, but other details of his story might not be true.
Yeah. And so, Amar, so the Times wasn't the only news outlet to report on him before this week. So particularly in Canadian news coverage, how did they describe this guy and what he had done before the arrest? My understanding is that there were some sort of discrepancies between the initial Canadian press coverage as opposed to what was presented in Caliphate and in the Times.
Right, yeah. So Rukmini meets him in November 2016, but the podcast isn't released until March 2018. So a solid, you know, year and a half or so goes by from the interview to when the podcast is released. During that time, Huzaifa speaks to the CBC and a few other journalists as well. And he tells them in those interviews that he did travel to Syria, but that he doesn't mention any murders. He doesn't mention killing anybody. And then, so the CBC article comes out, I think it was in late 2017, and makes a bit of a ripple, but doesn't really cause a whole lot of attention. And then the podcast drops a few months later, and you can, you know, hear him talking about, in vivid detail, having killed two people, describes, you know, the warmth of the blood that splashed on his face and things like that. And of course, Canadian media, and particularly the journalists who interviewed him in Canada, freak out about, you know, who's this guy lying to? Is he lying to the CBC or is he lying to the New York Times? And that kind of controversy brings the story into kind of more of a public light as well. So he's clearly telling two different stories to different people. The New York Times concludes that because they spoke to him before law enforcement had come knocking on his door in November 2016, that he's probably being more truthful to the New York Times. They kind of caught him in a moment of truth in a way. And then after law enforcement had interviewed him, he was much more careful about what he admitted to doing while in Syria. And so that's kind of how different parties to this are explaining the discrepancy in the narrative. But basically, it's just he admitted to killing people on the New York Times podcast, but during the CBC interview, he doesn't admit to any of it.
Okay, so Leah, that's sort of what is publicly known in some ways until this week. And then this week we get big news from Canadian law enforcement. So what is the allegation that Abu Huzaifa did?
So the RCMP have charged him with hoax terrorist activity, which is not a terrorism offense in Canadian law. But essentially, the allegation is, by charging somebody with this, is that they conveyed false information with the intent to cause fear in people. And the RCMP hasn't specified precisely what elements of his story they're saying are false. They have confirmed that Shiroz Chowdhury, who is the person that's been charged, is in fact the same person featured in the Caliphate podcast, and that information and other information available to them, seemingly through other journalists, as we talked about from the CBC and others, is the basis for their charge and their original investigation. They also make clear that they engaged in an intensive investigation, and that is what led to this, and that significant resources were used in that investigation to validate or disprove, in this case, the statements that he made to the Times and other reporters.
So we'll dive into all this a bit more in a second, but this is the Lawfare podcast, and I think a lot of Lawfare listeners might be curious to learn a bit more about sort of the charge, which is a bit strange to us in the US context. So could you just explain, like, is it at all common that someone gets charged with this? And what's the burden of proof on the government? How do you convict someone of this? What do they need to show?
So think of this as the calling in a bomb threat charge, right? That's really what was intended to get at. If someone calls in a fake bomb threat and creates fear that there is, you know, a real threat to life and property, and it, you know, causes law enforcement to run out and clear buildings and then investigate and yada, 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 that's what this charge is on the books and meant to address. And that's how we've actually seen it applied in the past. It's very unusual in this case because the charge requires that the individual intentionally convey false information, and that the intent behind that is to create fear of bodily harm, death, property damage as a result of a terrorist activity. So in this case, it's very interesting because the allegation is that he lied, but not about future activity that could cause harm. He lied about his past activity, because nowhere in the Caliphate podcast or in the CBC reporting does he claim to be a future threat to Canadians or that he has intentions to cause harm to Canadians. So the theory of the case must be that Canadians feared the fact that a so-called cold-blooded killer for ISIS was walking around in Canada, and that must generate fear in Canadians that they could be harmed from a terrorist activity, which I think is going to be very challenging to prove. They also need to prove that what he said was false. So in this case, they're going to need to prove the negative, that he did not commit the crimes that he said that he did to the Caliphate podcast or to CBC, which to me is very interesting. Having to prove a negative in criminal charges is very rare. And so it's also very interesting because we've had so few terrorism cases brought in Canada with respect to individuals who have been known to travel abroad and return, so that the investigative techniques and methods and what process the RCMP went through to prove that negative could be put on trial here, which is very uncomfortable for Canadian security services because we do have very robust disclosure obligations in Canada. And if I'm Chowdhury's defense attorney, I'm saying put all the evidence on the table of how you know he's lying, which would be very, very uncomfortable for security services.
Yeah, I want to come back to that in a second. But so as an initial matter, this sort of puts the Times, the New York Times, in a very interesting position. So on Wednesday, they came out with a statement about this saying, quote, "While the uncertainty about Abu Huzaifa's story was explored directly in the episodes of Caliphate that featured him, his arrest and the allegations surrounding it raised new and important questions about him and his motivations." And so they've also announced that they're taking a new look into the story and into Caliphate. And I should say as well that we had invited Rukmini to join us, but she declined. So I'll ask both of you, does the Times' explanation sound plausible to you? Is their characterization of what Caliphate depicted, is that sort of consistent with what your interpretation of the show was? Leo, I guess we can start with you.
I think that's fair. And I also think it's really important to remember that what you need to run a story, right, or to publish as a journalist is very different from what you need in terms of evidence to bring charges, right? Those are not the same standards. It's not the same burden of proof. So it's very plausible, based on everything that Amar just ran down, that they were confident enough that they were publishing a story that they could go to the mat and say, this is true. Mm-hmm. But that's not the level of evidence you need to, you know, to prove beyond reasonable doubt that someone committed an offense. They're two different standards. So ultimately, I think the criticism of the Caliphate podcast needs to be tempered by that fact.
Yeah, no, that definitely makes sense. Amar, anything to add to that?
No, I think I think that's about right. I think we have to remember that. I mean, it was the Caliphate podcast itself in Chapter 6 that raised all these questions to begin with about the accuracy of the story that he's telling, about the truth of his story, and so on. So it's not like that episode came later after they were challenged. They themselves found the discrepancies in his story. They themselves tried to prove it, and eventually, after speaking with national security reporters, after doing kind of insane level geolocation of mounds in Raqqa, mounds of sand in Raqqa, and then also talking to several captured prisoners, ISIS fighters in Syria, who seemed to have recognized Huzaifa, they came to the conclusion that the weight of evidence suggests that he at least went and was there, that maybe the specifics of the story, some of the specifics of the story might be embellished or false, but the overall kind of narrative that he traveled there was true. And so they were comfortable enough, the weight of evidence, to put it out there. But I mean, they sent somebody to his uncle's house in Pakistan to find out, you know, so it's not like they just kind of took his word for it. So they tried very hard to find the evidence and kind of prove his story. And we have to remember, reporting on Syria is a bit of a black hole in itself. I mean, the idea that you know what ISIS fighters are doing over there, what they do on a daily basis, aside from the fact that many of them had, you know, Twitter accounts in 2014 and were posting about their breakfasts and so on, we had very little idea of what they were doing over there when they got over there. And so being able to run those stories to the ground and somehow have a complete accurate picture is quite difficult and next to impossible. So I think, you know, given all that, I think the New York Times did a pretty good job in trying to verify the story.
Yeah, and I'll pose this to both of you before we sort of dive into what actually might be going on here. You're both people who've been following this case, I think, pretty closely. Were you surprised by the charge that came down this week? Amar, we can start with you.
I was very surprised. Yeah, I think I've been speaking to him, as I mentioned, fairly regularly since December 2016. And there's nothing in the way we communicate, you know, that made me doubt that he ever went there to begin with. And he also spent, I mean, this goes back to what Leo was talking about in terms of the intent to, you know, showing that he did all these interviews and he told all these stories with the intent to cause fear. it was very difficult to get him to do anything, right? I mean, the New York Times itself got several phone calls from him, got requests from him before the podcast went out to kill the story. He tried to pay the New York Times to kill the story. The CBC at one point had to go talk to him with a hidden camera because he refused to talk to them. And so this doesn't sound like someone who wanted to tell a story and get out there and create fear. In fact, he tried to kill most of these media stories before they came out. And so I think given all of that, I was very surprised by the charges. And I guess my main thing is I'm very curious now what the kind of evidence that the RCMP has that they think they can bring a case like this to the conclusion that they're looking for.
And Leah, did this sort of similar reaction on your end?
I'm surprised for all the reasons that Amar was, but for two other reasons as well. One, as I mentioned, because this kind of requires a contortion of the actual offense that will make things hard to prove for the prosecutor. But on the other hand, I'd been hearing for some time from within the security community that they didn't take him seriously. But I think the thing to highlight to American listeners is that terrorism offenses in Canada, in order to bring them, they need to be approved by both the provincial attorney general, because all offenses are basically tried by province, but we have a national criminal code, a federal criminal code. So it has to be approved by both the provincial attorney general, but then also the federal attorney general through the public prosecution service. So bringing terrorism offenses does require a lot of preparation, a lot of consideration, and a lot of consideration of the factors in terms of the public interest in bringing terrorism offenses. Because terrorist hoax isn't a terrorism offense, there was no need to consult with prosecutors to bring this charge. There was no sign-off from provincial attorneys general or federal attorney general before bringing this charge. I would like to believe that the RCMP probably consulted with prosecutors before bringing this, but that would have been a local prosecutor or perhaps a counsel with the National Security Investigative Team within the RCMP. But I can tell you that federal prosecutors were not consulted. And so I do think that it's from that perspective, I find it very interesting. This wasn't like they went up and down trying to decide what to charge him with, and then they narrowed in on this. It was done more locally than that. And it's going to be hard ultimately for those prosecutors to prove in court.
Right. So I want to try and tease out like what might actually be going on here. So with this charging decision, Leah, does this, like in your view, does this tell us anything about what could have plausibly happened? Like what this guy could have plausibly done? Or does it, on the other hand, does it rule anything out? Or does it, in your view, sort of suggest or imply certain types of evidence that Canadian authorities might have?
No. Okay. again, here, and I think the fact that, you know, federal prosecutors who usually bring terrorism prosecutions didn't need to be consulted on this is part of the reason why, right? So I would like to think that this means they chased it all down and there was no reason or no capacity to prove that he committed any terrorism offense whatsoever. And as a result, this is a total fabrication and therefore this is a hoax and we're going to move ahead with a hoax charge. But I don't know that that's actually the case here. I don't know, based on the charge, whether they are saying that the most egregious elements of his statements, you know, the really horrific type stuff was false, or if the entire thing is false, his entire story, I should say, is false. It's not clear, just because this is not how this offense was designed to be used, you know, telling stories about what you've done in the past, creating fear for the future. So it's plausible that they're going to say, well, sure, maybe he traveled to Syria, but we definitely know he didn't commit murder. Like, I don't know how you're going to prove that. I don't know how you're going to prove the negative in this case unless they can prove that he wasn't there at the time that he says he was, which might be possible, right? Like, investigators may have gone through this case And when they expected to find inculpatory evidence, found exculpatory evidence, and then repeatedly found exculpatory evidence after exculpatory evidence, right? Him not being where he said he was at the time. But I don't know that that means that he was never there and that he never fought or participated in a terrorist activity in Syria. Like, it's just not clear to me.
Interesting. So Amar had alluded to this earlier, but Leah, so part of the problem is that it's quite difficult to get evidence on what happened in Syria. And so part of the podcast is Rukmini sort of noting that she and Canadian law enforcement are in sort of a weirdly similar position. They're both trying to figure out who this guy is, what he might have done, whether he even went in the first place. I wonder if you could just talk a bit more about what those sort of evidentiary challenges are, particularly for law enforcement.
Well, Rukmini is at an advantage over Canadian law enforcement in one regard, in that Canadian officials typically, well, as far as we know in this case, have never traveled to Syria to investigate terrorism offenses. And the reason for that, I believe, actually stems back to the case of Omar Khadr, which found that to gain evidence, basically through the participation of a process that violates international human rights law, triggers additional responsibilities for state agents under the Canadian Charter of Rights and Freedoms, and will have implications for the admissibility of evidence, and may actually create available remedies, charter remedies, for individuals who are questioned by the RCMP, for example, while they're in detention in Syria under human rights violative conditions. So we haven't actually seen Canadian officials travel abroad. What Amar and I were there last fall, and you know, everyone that we talked to, and Amar was there previously, no one had been personally interviewed by Canadians overseas. So Canadian officials are not on the ground digging up this evidence. But at the same time, Canadians do have the benefit of their partners who are investigating and on the ground. So American officials that might be investigating what took place, conducting interviews. We know that the French and the English have also been gathering evidence and conducting interviews abroad. So they may have benefited from those relationships to gather information that would disprove Huzaifa's claims. But it's really not clear. There's also obviously signals intelligence, right, that could put him other places than where he said he was in Syria at the time, right? They could have been able to gather phone records from foreign partners or overseas agencies that linked him to Pakistan, for example, rather than Syria. So obviously the Canadian state has a deeper reach when it comes to that kind of evidence gathering, but they weren't on the ground.
Yeah. So Leah, I guess, first of all, have there been successful prosecutions in Canada of folks who are suspected of having left Canada to go and join the Islamic State? And if so, in those cases, how does the government sort of overcome those evidentiary concerns and maybe cases that are a bit more straightforward than this one?
So the straight answer is no. There have been prosecutions and convictions of individuals for attempting to travel or for traveling overseas. But usually what happens is we see people get picked up in Turkey, return to Canada, and then they're prosecuted for attempting to travel overseas. We've had one case of an individual who left, came back, left again, right? And he got charged with trying to leave to participate in a terrorist organization, right? So we've seen our first two charges for individuals who actually are alleged to have traveled abroad, committed acts and participated with ISIS, including a kidnapping, and returned to Canada. The allegation is that they went and returned in 2013 and 2014, and they were only just charged, these two individuals, in the last 2 months. One was last week, actually, the day before the Huzaifa charge. So that took 7 years to bring that charge. And these are the first two to actually be charged for getting to Syria and participating with ISIS. And whether or not that's successful will be interesting, but, you know, terrorism law watchers like myself are really interested to see why now and what the evidence is that was sufficient to bring this charge that prosecutors believe they're going to be successful or can be successful in prosecuting the two Borjats for what they did abroad.
So for both of you, I'm curious. So you guys are neither the New York Times nor Canadian intelligence services, but you mentioned that you both went over to Syria to try and do some field work. How do you sort of navigate the challenges of figuring out like what actually happened in Syria? It seems like everyone, both law enforcement, researchers, journalists, report that there are these sort of real difficulties in determining what's going on. And how do you sort of manage to think about that? Amar, I guess we can start with you.
Yeah, I mean, it's massively difficult. And I've interviewed dozens of fighters when they were over there. I've interviewed dozens of returning fighters. And I don't generally go down these kinds of questions for that reason, right? The kind of what kind of crimes did you commit? Where were you at this particular time? And those kinds of questions, because I think mainly to protect myself, but at the same time, I think they're generally going to lie about those kinds of questions that might incriminate themselves or put some of their family members in trouble. And so from a research perspective, I generally tend to ask about much more life history or life story kinds of questions that they're more likely to open up about and more likely to be honest about. So I think with Huzaifa, I mean, when me and him speak, we obviously do talk about these issues because it's in the media quite a bit. And what I've noticed with him, and I think Rukmini has noticed with him, is he does genuinely have emotional reactions to some of these stories that he's telling. And so when he's talking about murders or when he's talking about witnessing murders or when he's talking about escaping, he has, you know, physical reactions. He cries, he stares off into the distance, his fingers start to shiver. And so I'm not a psychologist, and I don't know how you do that if you totally make up a story. And I don't know if those physical reactions are indicative of having lived through something or not. But I think these are the kinds of things that made a lot of us, I think, confident that at least the broad trajectory of his story were accurate, that he didn't just make up the whole thing. Because it would, I don't know. I don't know how you burst into tears over a story that you invented in your head, aside from, you know, being Meryl Streep or something.
And Leah, anything to add to that, both with this specific case or just sort of in general?
Yeah, I don't treat it as my job to get to the bottom of it. I'm not a reporter and I'm not an investigator. I interview people with trying to understand if they understood the legal ramifications, if they were deterred at all by criminal sanctions and how they view the criminal justice system's impact on them now. So I just don't pursue that line of questioning because it's not relevant and that's not my job.
Yeah, no, that makes sense to me. So one of the things I'm curious about is sort of the way in which the Abu Huzaifa story has played out in Canada. So with the initial reporting and after the caliphate story came out, was this like a big deal in Canada? How was it sort of picked up on the political level? Amar, I'm curious about that.
Yeah, the initial CBC reporting made a bit of a ripple, but it didn't cause the firestorm that came in March 2018. The thing with the podcast was it wasn't, you know, a one-time story that dropped in people's lives and then disappeared. It was a weekly release with a guy talking, you know, slowly and emotively about what he had done. And so it kept the story in the news for an extended period of time because every week there was a new revelation. Every week there was something for Canadian media to report about and investigate. And so over the entire course of the 10-part series, it made a lot of separate media waves that kind of kept it in people's minds, which then, of course, was taken up by the Conservative Party of Canada in the House of Commons as a hammer against the Liberal government to say, you know, we know the New York Times is reporting that there's a trained ISIS fighter walking the streets of Canada and you can't charge him. What do you have to say about that? And so then it became a political issue. It made several waves of media around that time and became a major political issue as well.
And so one of the things you both wrote a very good piece in Slate, which I would encourage people to read about sort of the news of this week. And one of the points that you made is that sort of the podcast and the story of Abu Huzaifa in general might have had an impact on the approach of the Canadian government to handling Canadian nationals who went over, at least were alleged to have gone over and joined the Islamic State. So could you, Amar, just first sort of explain what is the Canadian government's position on either repatriating these people or sort of the general approach to it? And two, talk a bit about what the impact of this story might have been on that policy.
Sure. In terms of the Canadian government's policy on repatriating prisoners we have over there, there isn't really an open policy, as far as I can tell. There's been some events held kind of behind closed doors on different issues affecting the repatriation debate, like children, psychological well-being of children, how to reintegrate children, and so on. But none of that has become, none of that has led to any real policy to actually bring people back, any real initiative to bring them back. Why I think the podcast had, you know, some impact, it wasn't the only thing, of course, but some impact on shift in policy was, me and Stuart Bell from Global News were in Syria October 2018, and we spoke to a lot of Kurdish officials and some Canadian prisoners there. And one of the things they told us was, you know, there was a lot of phone calls coming in from Canadian officials in April of that year, talking to prisoners, talking to women, getting their names, their date of births, their citizenship, with the intent of eventually giving them ID documents to bring them back home. And so this was a kind of initial conversation that was happening with the objective of eventually bringing some of these individuals home. Those calls came to an abrupt halt in May of 2018, shortly after, I think anyway, the podcast dropped and some of the fallout in the House of Commons and some of the shouting matches in the House of Commons. And so I think whether it was a shift in policy or whether it was an impact on already existing policy, it's difficult to know. And I don't think it was the only thing that influenced Canadian policy, but it was a real flashpoint, I think, for some officials to say, okay, this is more of a political issue than maybe we initially imagined. And then maybe we want to think about it some more. Those calls came to an abrupt end in May 2018, and they haven't started again, right? And so there hasn't been a shift or kind of reopening of that conversation for some time.
And among those politicians who sort of took this story as, you know, evidence that there's a serious problem and that the Canadian policy needs to shift in one way or another, how have they, if at all, sort of responded to the news of this week? Has it caused renewed uproar, or seems like it has, you know, caused people to reconsider their positions, anything like that?
I don't think that conversation has started yet. I mean, I kind of mentioned this on Twitter a while back to say if the RCMP is correct and Huzaifa did make up his whole story and you know, a lot of the political fallout was related to his story, then what does that mean for the kind of repatriation debate? But of course, I think it wasn't the only thing that influenced the repatriation debate. And I think the political fallout having an impact is a separate issue than whether Huzaifa's story is true or not, right? So it was more of the, this is what happens when we talk about ISIS returnees. This is the fallout that we see, regardless of whether the individual story is accurate or not, doesn't matter.
And I think it's really important to remember that it was a shift in dialogue, right? So while the approach of the Trudeau government prior to the Caliphate podcast and the justification potentially that they could have offered to Canadians for repatriation would have been more consistent with early Trudeau government language around Canadians involved with ISIS. You know, a Canadian is a Canadian is a Canadian. As soon as you now have somebody allegedly in Canada who committed murder and there's, you know, a real flashpoint in the Commons, that forces a change in how the Trudeau government addressed these issues, right? And it became an issue that was widely discussed amongst the Canadian public. And the general sense from many Canadians speaking out about this was, let them rot over there. We should not be bringing these people home if we can't prosecute them, right? Because that was what was happening, that there was no trust that people could be returned to Canada and that they would face any sort of criminal sanctions for what they've done. And that's become the rooted understanding of things, right? And so whether or not it changes now, that's the common understanding. That's the common picture that people are working with within Canada. So it would be much more challenging to change the narrative now that it's become a part of just the Canadian understanding of ISIS members, ISIS returnees, and Canada's ability to prosecute individuals for their participation. And it would be much harder to have a very sensible conversation that Amar and I have been trying to have with people for the last 2 years about repatriation, about the reasons for repatriation, about why it's actually advantageous for our security to bring people home, now that this narrative has kind of stuck into the common consciousness of Canadians.
Yeah, so we have to wrap up in a little bit, but I'm sort of curious to do a bit of like a lessons learned. So Leah, on the government side, so for intelligence services and law enforcement in countries where there are nationals who left to join the Islamic State, and that's, you know, the United States, a bunch of countries in Western Europe, but also countries in Central Asia and in Southeast Asia, the same basic challenges that we see in this case, although in very dramatic form, play out in lots of different cases, right? So there's the task of trying to figure out, did someone actually go to Syria? What did they do while they were there? You know, how can we get evidence to build a criminal case if that's what the country wants? So are there any lessons to be drawn here? I know you mentioned that in particular, the Canadian government doesn't, you know, go over to Syria to investigate these crimes. So maybe that's a place to start, but anything else as well?
I don't think the Canadian situation is necessarily comparable to other states because of some of the hurdles we have that have been created through our common law and rooted in the Charter of Rights and Freedoms in Canada. So issues around disclosure being that they are, we have probably the most permissive disclosure regime of any country in the common law world, which makes things very challenging when you're talking about investigations that start as national security investigations, right? So that start in the hands of CSIS and then move into criminal prosecutions. It makes it tremendously challenging to bring those prosecutions because the security officials are just not willing to reveal sources, methods, and techniques which would be needed in order to have a fair trial under Canadian law. And because of the uncertainty around what it means if Canadians were to go and interrogate or investigate these offenses abroad and to actually communicate, not just security officials, right? Even consular officials to go in and to speak with people and get their information while they're being held in Syria. There's so much uncertainty around that law because of really actually terrible Supreme Court jurisprudence in the Supreme Court case of Hape and then in Qatar. It's just such a unique accumulation of circumstances that makes this really hard in Canada. And I don't think it's at all comparable to what you're seeing in the United States, where, you know, as of yesterday, the United States was saying that they have now repatriated every single American that they have charges against. It's very different.
Yeah. So that's the one side, is the sort of government side. And the other sort of, I mean, the other relevant issue here is sort of what it means to tell a story about the Islamic State, or sort of to tell a story about the war on terror in general. So I'll open this up to both of you, and Leah, we can start with you. So for researchers and for journalists, what do you feel like the whole experience of this case, and obviously it's not over yet, what does it reveal about what it's like and sort of what the constraints are in telling a meaningful and responsible story about the Islamic State?
Not a journalist. So it's really hard for me to answer that question. But as someone thinking about this from the perspective of, you know, defense counsel, the interesting thing for me here is that Abu Huzaifa or Shirouz Chaudhry didn't ultimately have control over how his story was told. That was done by the journalists who interviewed him. And the fear that may have been instilled in Canadians as a result of what he said is in part attributable to how his story was told. When you tell his story in black and white in print, and you know, in one paragraph explain his story, and in another paragraph you explain the reasons for why he may be lying, that's one thing. when you tell a story in a heavily produced podcast with scary music, you know, over the course of 5 weeks, and then in a sixth week, you then tell people why he might be lying, that impacts how people perceive the threat and perceive the story. So how you tell the story here in this case, when we're talking about someone alleged to have intended to cause fear, I think that's a very interesting thing to consider, is his story was told by others, not just by him.
Amar, to close, I'll ask the same question to you.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, Syria, the conflict in Syria is probably the most mediated conflict in history, but it's also a bit of a black hole, right? I mean, what we know about the conflict kind of trickles out in scraps of documents, in random interviews, in releases by some of these movements and groups themselves. And so on one level, it's very hard to get information out of there, very hard to get reliable information out of there. So that's kind of one broader point. But I think in terms of talking to individuals, I mean, that's always been, you know, in sociology, not to get too nerdy here, but in sociology, we call it the problem of accounts, right? How do you know that anything that people tell us is true? We know that people retroactively kind of rewrite their past to, you know, suit the needs of the present. If you talk to converts, religious converts, they'll often rewrite their past as this like gloomy period where they were lost and confused, and you know, they grew up in a very repressive household, and all kind of leading up to this point of conversion, which was a magical experience. And so depending on where people are at any given point in their life, they often kind of retroactively rewrite what happened to them in the past to kind of suit their needs at the present. And so humans are complicated. They lie. They lie to protect themselves. They lie to protect others. They lie because they feel guilty. And so I think all of that has been known for some time. It's not just in the terrorism space or people who study the Islamic State. And so those challenges continue. That doesn't mean we stop talking to people or stop learning from people, but I think recognizing that humans are complicated is important first step, and that we may, as researchers or journalists, you know, get it wrong once in a while, I think has to be a running assumption.
And that is all the time we have today. Thank you both very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
The Lawfare Podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. Your audio engineer this week was Zachary Frank, and your editor and producer, as always, was Jen Patia Howell. Your music was performed by Sophia Yan. We hope that you rate and review the Lawfare Podcast wherever you get your podcasts, and that you share us widely. Thanks very much for listening.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.